Okay, so I would like to thank the organizers for having me. It's nice to be here. So what I'm going to talk about today is joint work with Per, and we are both sitting in Stockholm. So this is about long-run labor supply. And what we mean by long-run labor supply is what this paper is all about is how many hours people choose to work on average. And what we mean by work is work in the marketplace. The starting point of this analysis is to ask the empirical questions, how average hours worked in the population have been changing in the long run. And by the long run, we mean the very long run, so over several decades or 100 years plus. And let me start to motivate the paper with this graph, which summarizes the takeaway message from this empirical exercise. So this is one historical data source, medicine data, and what we have here is for 25 countries that are nowadays developed, we have estimates for average hours worked per capita over the last 140 years. And kind of one striking thing, one main takeaway message from this picture is that for all those countries we have data for, if you go back 100 years, people have been working harder 100 years ago than they do nowadays. And also in terms of magnitude, this is kind of significant order of magnitude, this decline. So roughly if you go back 100 years, the takeaway message is that people used to work roughly twice as hard as they do nowadays. This is nothing new, because we just take a standard data set and plot it against time. Maybe the only slightly original thing we did here is that we put it on a logarithmic scale. So logarithmic scale means that you can interpret linear lines as growth rates.
So this picture doesn't control for the sectoral compositional change?
No, exactly. So, this is just a main motivation picture, but I'm going to talk at some length about empirical data and other data sets. Also, a lot of things you might want to take into consideration, we just take it per capita. So, for instance, here in this graph, we don't control for demographics. What I'm going to show you later is that it's not driven by demographics, and so on and so forth. So I'm going to talk at some length about the empirical part of this project later. But just the main takeaway message is that if you go back 140 years, people have been roughly working twice as hard. And if you put it on a logarithmic scale, at least to us, with our eyeballing technique, we think that a linear slope on this logarithmic scale seems to be a good first pass-through approximation of this data. And then you can calculate the growth rate, which is implied by the slope. And what you conclude then is that it's roughly declining at 0.45% per year. So hours worked per capita are, over this time horizon, roughly declining at 0.45% per year. It's not a large decline. It's not an extremely fast decline, but it is a significant decline. Now, this is just one data source we choose here, but I think there is a consensus among economic historians that this is roughly what had happened over the course of development. Clearly, you should take those first observations with a grain of salt. It's a messy business to construct those historical estimates of hours worked, also of GDP. But I think there is really a consensus among economic historians that this is what has happened, even quantitatively. Now, let's move to the macro literature. And just to highlight that this is not only a consensus among economic historians, this is actually also something that is very well acknowledged in the core macroeconomic literature. So you can go to the textbook by Barrow, you can go to the textbook by Mankiw, and you find the quote. Actually, Mankiw reminds us of this famous essay by Keynes in the 30s, where Keynes was speculating about the fortune of his grandchildren. And in this piece, he's speculating that 100 years down the road, his grandchildren will only work 15 hours a week because they are so productive, so they don't have to work harder. And then, clearly, what this implies is that Quantitatively, Keynes was completely off, of course. We still work much harder than 15 hours, but we are going in this direction, and maybe one day even the quantitative prediction by Keynes becomes true. You can also go to Cooley and Prescott, and they also have the quote, there is evidence that leisure per capita increased steadily until the 1930s. And this quote is about the US. So you kind of, you see the discrepancy because clearly there is clear empirical evidence that in the long run labor supply is declining. This is also well acknowledged in the core macro literature. But at the same time, you also know that kind of this successful neoclassical growth framework, that is a success story because it can rationalize this co-movement of the key macroeconomic variables like consumption, output, capital accumulation, wages, interest rates. So this macroeconomic framework, this neoclassical growth model that can account for this co-movement of those key variables is inconsistent with this observation, because usually either the endogenous labor supply is not considered, so it's just assumed that labor supply is constant and equal to unity, if you wish, or the neoclassical growth theory relies on a framework, a utility function, where income and substitution effect cancel out such that labor supply is constant in the long run, no matter how wages grow. So for this reason, what we do in this paper is we're going to change the framework. So what we would like to do is we would like to provide a framework that allows you to replicate this decline in hours worked. And we would like to do that in an otherwise standard neoclassical growth framework. So we would like to explain this decrease in hours worked as people's choice. So in this respect, we take a neoclassical perspective. And I think the main justification for this neoclassical perspective is because we are really considering a long time period. So clearly, if you think about today or tomorrow, maybe your hours worked might be influenced by some rules, by unions, by the law or whatever. But in the long run, over several decades or even 100 years, it's very unlikely, or it's reasonable to assume that all those institutions should be endogenous. Or put it differently, if a majority of the French population would like to work as hard as they did 140 years ago, there would be a way to find an institutional arrangement to make this possible. So in this respect, we're going to take a neoclassical perspective, and we would like to square this observation that hours worked are falling at a steady rate, more or less, with the otherwise standard growth facts, which describe or paint a relatively balanced picture of growth. So output is growing at a steady rate over the remarkably steady rate over the last 140 years. Consumption is doing so, wages, and so on and so forth. So in this sense, we would like to integrate this empirical observation and reconcile it with an otherwise standard theory. So we put some mild restriction on preferences. So we assume that preferences are additively separable over time. We have standard discounting, time discounting. Then the utility of function, instantaneous utility function is only defined over consumption and hours worked and is stationary over time. So it's the same utility function each period. It's not changing over time. So those are pretty standard assumptions. And what we then ask is there such a preference specification that gives us changing hours worked, falling hours worked, and at the same time balanced growth path in the other key macroeconomic variables? And the answer to this question is, at least surprising to us, yes, there are utility functions that give you a balanced growth path, and at the same time, falling hours worked in the long run. And the kind of the main contribution, main theoretical contribution of this paper is to give you a full characterization of utility functions that are consistent with a balanced growth path. So this is kind of the main theorem of this paper, is a full characterization of this class of utility function that give you a balanced growth path. Kind of what we then do, we have some additional sections where we speculate a little bit. First of all, we show that within this utility function that we defined, within this class of utility function we defined, we retrieve some well-known, often used cases, which are often used in the more micro literature that abstracts from growth. And kind of the surprising thing is that those cases are, in fact, consistent with a balanced growth path as soon as you allow for changing hours worked in the long run. Now, in terms of mechanism, maybe I have to disappoint you. So in terms of mechanism, there is nothing really new here. So our analysis is just relying on the income and substitution effect of changing wages. And the only thing we argue here is that in order to be consistent with the long-run data I showed you, you need to have a framework where the income effect is slightly dominating the substitution effect. So it's nothing new in terms of mechanism. Yeah. And then, of course, once we have this framework, we can speculate a little bit how we analyze through the lens of this framework the past data and what it implies also for the future. And, of course, the takeaway message there is that if you believe that productivity keeps on growing, so wages keep on growing also in the future, then the implication of our theory is that we expect to see a further fall in hours worked in the future as well. So let me kind of the roadmap is I'm going to talk a little bit about the empirical part of this paper, where we establish this fact or make this point that in the long run, if you talk about 100 years, it's a robust finding that hours worked are falling. So we look at different data sources and data sets. So what we would like to have is kind of a measure of hours worked, of actual market hours worked, which includes overtime and subtracts holiday. We play around with different units of observations. The standard thing we do is to restrict attention to working age population, which is done in the literature as well. And we would like to look at different countries and a long time horizon. Let me start with this picture. So this picture is, I think, the famous picture. And this picture is the main justification why the macro literature almost exclusively focused on constant hours work. So this follows basically an updated version of Rogerson. So this shows you average hours worked per year per working age population, which is defined as age 15 to 64, in the US, in the post-war US, so since the 50s. And of course, well, it is slightly decreasing. Then there is this remarkable period where they go up. And then it's well known that since early 2000s, hours worked have been falling dramatically also in the US. But of course, the key takeaway message of this picture is that, and I think we all agree, that a horizontal line in this picture gives a fine approximation of this data series. And I think this observation, together with maybe a bit of US centrism in the literature, has given rise to this emphasis on hours work being constant in the long run. Now, let's take the same data set and look at different countries. So let's look at other OECD countries, like UK, like France, like Germany, Japan. What we then see is that it is a bit harder to argue that a horizontal line is the best approximation of this data. Kind of what we see is there is a lot of heterogeneity. So the level is different, the slopes are different. But overall, and I again put it on a logarithmic scale, so you can interpret the linear slopes as growth rates, And if you do this analysis, what this suggests is, again, kind of overall, in this post-war period, of OECD countries, of some selected OECD countries, on average, hours worked per capita decrease at 0.45% per year, overall. Again, there is a lot of heterogeneity, which is, of course, interesting, and but kind of it's clear that overall the trend is not flat, but rather declining. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Quick question about the data. It seems that for most of these countries, the slope flattens out in the more recent periods. And I wonder if you've looked into whether this is systematically correlated with levels of income growth. So in the US, they start with a higher level of income per capita. It flattens out, it seems, earlier in the 1950s. This here flattens out in maybe the 90s.
Yeah. No, so that's true. I mean, in the first picture, I even did the analysis. I think I calculated from the 50 onwards the slope coefficient, and it is slightly smaller than the one in the overall sample. So I think it's 0.46 compared to 0.39. So it's slightly smaller. I agree. And you're right. I mean, also for the post-war sample, you can find countries where it flattens out. Kind of according to our theory. I mean, one thing is, kind of what we try to establish here is a really long-run trend. So it's not enough to look at maybe 10 or 20 years of data to detect the trend, because it's a relatively small moving trend. And clearly, there are also other things like changes in the tax system, in the transfer system, and so on and so forth, and they might all influence the data series as well. So it's, I wouldn't just look at 10 years and then conclude anything from that. So we should look at longer data series. But you're right. I mean, you can argue that for some countries it seems to slow down a little bit. Now then, through the lens of our theory, it would, because our theory connects this decrease in hours worked or this increase in leisure to productivity growth. So clearly, once you have this theory, it makes the theoretical implication that as productivity decreases, you would expect to see a slowdown also in decreasing hours worked. Yeah.
So these pictures are all average annual hours, and you'll have a representative agent framework, I assume. Do you have any sense about whether the declining annual or average hours comes from everyone working less? Or
yeah, I'm going to talk about it. I think that's one of the next slides. But yeah, so clearly, you're right. It's an interesting exercise. So this is just average hours worked, as you said. And you can differentiate, or you can take it in two pieces. One is the intensive margin, and the other one the extensive margin. So hours worked per worker that is working, and the participation rate, basically. What we then find is, if we do that, is that it's mainly driven by the intensive margin. So the participation rate in the long run and across countries is not moving that much. The participation rate, clearly, there are some swings. There are some considerable swings. But overall, there is no clear pattern in terms of the participation rate. Whereas the hours worked per worker, so the intensive margin, is behind this picture, and also the one I showed you before.
When you say participation margin, also the friction, if you had higher friction on unemployment, for example, that would also show up there.
So it's,
so it's not due to the fact that you have, for example, it could have been that frictional unemployment has gone up. That's not
That's not there. No. Behind this picture, what is behind this picture, and also the other one is hours worked per worker are falling. And of course, in a long run perspective, this is at some level not really surprising, because kind of, if you talk about holidays, this is a more recent phenomenon in a historical perspective. 100 years ago, people have been working 6 days a week and certainly more than 8 hours
a
day.
Could you distinguish by skills as well? I mean, is it the case that it's more pronounced for, you know, higher skill, they work less but, you know, more efficiently, or is there any, have you looked at
Not in this project. No,
yeah.
we just, I mean, also in terms of theory, in the end, we're going to have a representative agent framework. So it's really core macro framework to explain the data. But I mean, there are some interesting facts about cross-sectional behavior, because in historical data, kind of the high-skilled and also rich people tend to work little. So I don't know, 150 years ago, kind of high-skilled people and also wealthy people didn't work much, whereas the low-skilled people were working hard. And for the U.S., kind of nowadays, this is the opposite, because nowadays we have a lot of evidence that in the U.S., kind of high-skilled people, young people in their 30s work a lot. And
it could be also, I mean,
so it is kind of seems to have reverted.
It could be interesting also because it could be, you see, for example. For example, we work a lot because we love what we do. I mean, you know, we have fun.
Oh, that's okay? Right.
If you were, you know, stamping envelopes, you know,
yeah, no, that's right.
Reason differently. So there are many things going on there, and that'd be very interesting to understand. You know, to understand why.
I mean,
maybe the jobs that were like the stamp, you know, have
gone away.
Between the various kind of jobs, have evolved,
yeah.
Or the.
I fully agree. I fully agree. This kind of.
So it could be that you know the jobs are more interesting than others, but it could also be that you know now with the technological progress, you can earn quicker what you need and you stop.
Sure.
So, is your theory? I want to anticipate.
No.
You know somehow.
That's right.
Process, and you substitute it with robots or machines or of course you know we can't identify this strictly from the facts, right? But so you go in one way.
No,
I'm not sure how you're going to identify your explanation.
Sure. I mean, what will be behind is productivity growth, of course. So of course, what is driving the whole thing here? Will be productivity growth, for this reason wages increase, and because income effects slightly dominate substitution effect, people choose to take more time off and enjoy more leisure.
But that's it's a choice, it's not that firms need less working hours.
No, it's going to be a neoclassical framework, so there is no involuntary unemployment or something like that. Yeah.
Well, are you going to describe the data a bit more or not? It would be nice to show what you're able to see in the data. For instance, can you decompose it by sector or not? So again,
yeah.
I'm getting a little bit stuck on this issue, you know, because I don't know how to compare, you know, how to compute hours 100 years ago, how people are computing the hours that people were spending on the field versus people who are working in a firm in manufacturing factory. Like how? So that's why. For instance, comparing apples to apples would be more sensible.
So kind of this trend actually we see in the all major sectors. So this trend we see in the agriculture sector nowadays in the post. I agree that it is a messy business to come up with those historical numbers. And I mean, where we have very good numbers is for the manufacturing sector because there it's kind of they had a book where they keep track of working hours. But I agree the historical numbers. For the agriculture sector, and I agree that the agriculture sector was important historically. I don't know, kind of they did a lot of extrapolation, and I don't know.
So you don't observe the sectoral decomposition, basically. You're just observing the data, a single number.
In the medicine data, we don't. In other data sources, we see kind of maybe not as far back in time, but what we there observe is, I mean, we don't have it in the paper actually, but what we observe there is that if you look at the three main sectors like agriculture, services, and manufacturing, you see this decreasing trend in all sectors. It's not that it's going down in agriculture and actually going up in manufacturing or something like that. Yeah. So in this sense, structural transformation clearly, quantitatively can accelerate the trend, but it can never offset the trend. Yeah. Sure.
One more dimension when we're thinking about the data, gender. Obviously, there's been immense changes in female labor force participation over this time period, and it's changed, and it's also different across different countries, but that's actually going to push in the other direction, I think. So I think this is just basically to reinforce what other people have said. Like, if, I mean, depending on exactly what you want us to take from the summary stats to think about when we're thinking about your model, it might be worth kind of just honing in on, you know, controlling for sector, control for country, control for gender, female labor force participation. Then we might be able to have a clearer picture.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. I mean, it depends on the definition. In a sense, we take a very conservative definition, kind of in line with the literature, but some other people even like to focus on only male workers. And then, of course, the decrease is even more pronounced. Some other people also tend to have a more general definition of hours worked, which includes home production. It's a well-established fact that home production also fell over those 100 years. Then, of course, you get a more pronounced decrease. So, in a sense, when we talk about the quantitative part of those graphs, we are on the more conservative side, I would say. Okay, so, yeah, let me move on a little bit on the empirical part, but let me also spend some time on this, and then maybe be a bit brief on the theory. So, kind of this is other OECD countries, post-war period, same data source as we saw before for the US. Now let's go further back in time in the US. And this is kind of what we get if we go further back in time. So this is Remy and Francis data. And we again see that if we abstract from the Great Recession and World War, we see a clear decline. Then there is this remarkable period from the 80s till beginning of 2000 where hours worked have been increasing in the US quite steeply. Since then, and this data ends in 2005, but since then it has been falling again, and is roughly here nowadays. So overall, I think the takeaway message is that not only if we compare to other countries, but also in a historical perspective, the US seems more like an outlier and certainly not like a prime example how hours worked are behaving in the long run. So, and this is kind of the summary of the empirical observations and some further observations. So you can split it up in the intensive and extensive margin. I've been talking about this. So this is kind of the intensive margin, and you see kind of the whole trend is driven by the intensive margin. And this is extremely robust. And also across sector, you see this. Whereas the participation rate is really stationary. Then it goes up in the 80s, and since then it has been falling again. You don't see a clear overall trend in the participation rate. And this is, again, because clearly the female participation rate, female labor force participation has been increasing. But this is canceled out because people retire earlier overall. Yeah. Yeah. So there is it's also related to a small additional literature beginning with Winston in the 60s. Clearly, what we establish here is the slightly larger income effect and substitution effect. So another way to look at the same implication is to look at cross-sectional data. So you look at the correlation between hours worked and GDP per capita across countries, and this literature indeed finds a negative correlation between GDP per capita and hours worked in a cross-country data set. And there is a more recent paper by Beek, Fulschindel, and Lakos where they update this and do it for a larger data set, which even includes developing countries. Okay, so main takeaway message, the US data looks more like an outlier. The US post-war data looks more like an outlier in a historical perspective. If you go further back in time, if you include pre-war period, hours worked have been falling also in the US. Clearly, it also looks more like an outlier if you compare it to other countries. In other OECD countries, hours worked, even in the post-war period, have been falling quite dramatically. And just in terms of magnitude, if you want, what we see is roughly, those estimates we find is between 0.3 and 0.5% per year, hours worked are falling. Okay. So this is not an extremely fast decrease, it's a modest decrease. I would say it's economically significant, but just to interpret this number, 0.4 would imply that if you work 40 hours, if people work 40 hours today a week, they would work 20 hours in 175 years. So just to give you order of magnitude. So it's not an extremely fast decline, but I would say it's significant. And of course, it's not enough, as I said, it's not enough to just look at 10 or 20 years of data and to conclude whether it's whether you can detect this trend or not. Okay. So let me move on towards the theory. So as I said, we would like to kind of include this in an otherwise standard neoclassical framework, which is consistent with the other long-run growth facts. Because clearly, in a neoclassical framework, how much hours you work or people choose to work will depend on what wages are doing, how wages grow, how consumption is moving. And for those variables, we have these balanced growth facts. And here is just a summary of those facts. GDP per capita on a logarithmic scale, it's linear. Consumption, the consumption output ratio and capital output ratio. So those are the growth, balanced growth facts that we have steady growth in consumption, output, capital, and wages. And in this respect, we take a balanced growth perspective. That's why it is in the title. So we ask the question how we can build a framework that is consistent with falling hours along such a path. So this kind of is the completely standard workhorse macro framework. We have a one-sector economy. Capital tomorrow is produced with a neoclassical production function. This is capital left over after depreciation and consumption. So this is a neoclassical production function defined over capital and this labor composite, which is Herod-Newton technical progress, hours, and maybe population, if you wish. We assume that technology and population is growing at steady rates, and then we define, as I said before, a balanced growth path as a path along which capital output and consumption is growing to constant rate. And if you just look at the resource constraint, what you then immediately observe is that the only way how this can be consistent with a balanced growth path is if this composite is growing at the same rate as this composite and at the same rate as this composite, and this is the restriction you get out of it. So here are the preferences. As I said, we put some mild restrictions on preferences, completely in line with the literature. So we assume additively separable preferences. The instantaneous utility function is only defined over consumption and hours worked, and is stationary over time. Then, no matter what you like, you can have an infinite time horizon, you can have an overlapping generation model or a perpetual youth model or whatever you like. Kind of the preference structure you get is this one. So utility today plus the discounted utility from tomorrow, and this utility function is only defined over C and H, consumption and hours worked. And the representative household is then maximizing this utility flow subject to a standard resource constraint. And what you get is are those two first order conditions. One is just a standard Euler equation, and the other one is a standard trade-off between consumption and leisure. Okay. So those are the two first order conditions, and we're going to work with those two first order conditions to prove our theorem. So what we would like to have is a balanced growth path where the interest rate is constant, where the wages are growing at the constant rate, which is equal to the growth rate of technical change. The gross growth factor is gamma. Furthermore, we have these feasibility restrictions. And from this feasibility restriction, if we plug it in, we can see immediately kind of the wages are growing at the technical change, which is exogenous. Then we parameterize. Hours worked will be moving now, in general, along the balanced growth path. And we parameterize this as gamma to the minus nu, where nu is a new preference parameter we introduce. And this preference parameter is controlling how strong the income relative to the substitution effect is. So if nu is equal to zero, this will be equal to one. You don't have any change in hours worked, and you are back in the standard framework where income and substitution effect cancel out.
Yeah.
Yes, that's where we are going. Yes, exactly. So exactly. The name of the game is to set up, just in terms of first order conditions and feasibility constraint, what we need to get a balanced growth path where hours worked are changing, and then, and this is the main proof, we're going to integrate those first order conditions up to come up with the most general functional form of the preferences for this of this utility function here that gives you such a framework. So those are the first order conditions, and now we would like to have those first order conditions should not only hold in one point in time, they should hold in along an entire sequence. So they should hold along an entire path. So for each W, for each consumption level, for each rate of technical change, there should exist a balanced growth hours worked in 0.0. There should exist a balanced growth interest rate, such that those first order conditions hold, and they not only hold for one point in time, they hold for an entire sequence where you can scale up all the equilibrium variables, C, H, W, at their corresponding growth factors. Okay. This is basically assumption one, just in words. What we then ask is the question, what is the most general function form of utility function that is consistent with this assumption one, that gives you, as an interior solution, a balanced growth path. And here is the result. So this is our main theorem. Our main theorem is that in order to get balanced growth, you need the utility function over consumption and hours work that takes this function form, or you need to be able to write it in this function form. It needs to be a power function in C times an arbitrary function V of a special composite, which is H times C to the nu over 1 minus nu. And if you let sigma go towards 1, you get the log case. That's a special case. Okay. Now, kind of one first observation here is that if you set nu equal to 0, this is a famous class of utility function. Because if you set nu equal to 0, income and substitution effect cancel out, you're left with C times V of H, and this is the famous King-Prosser-Abelló class of preferences, or sometimes more descriptively called balanced growth preferences, which is the most general functional form of preferences that is consistent with a balanced growth path and constant hours worked. What we do here is, in this sense, a generalization, because we drop the additional assumption that ours should be constant and prove the more general balanced growth preferences. So nu has the interpretation of controlling the relative strength of income and substitution effect. If nu is zero, we are back in King-Prosser-Abelló. If nu is positive, income effects slightly dominate. So just some words how we prove that, maybe. We prove it with two lemmas. So I learned something while proving this, because it was a bit of a new problem for me, because you have to deal with those first order conditions, so you have to integrate those functions up. And of course, once you integrate with respect, and the problem is we have two arguments, right? So once you integrate up with respect to one argument, a new arbitrary function of the other argument pops up. And then you have to go back and cross-check and put some restriction on this arbitrary function to go on, and you have to do it twice. So it is a bit, it's not a very elegant proof, but that's how it is. Yeah. So kind of, some comments on the theorem. So remarkably, theorem one restricts only preferences. So in a sense, it's quite powerful, because what it tells you is that for any neoclassical production function with standard properties, like a constant returns to scale, if we use a utility function in this class and it's consistent with those first order conditions, then there will be a balanced growth path. And along this balanced growth path, all the equilibrium variables, the growth rates of all the equilibrium variables, are pinned down by the rate of technical change and these preference parameters. That's all you need to know to describe the growth rate of all equilibrium variables. So in this sense, it's quite powerful. Clearly, we derived everything in terms of assumption one. And if you go back to assumption one, you see that what we assumed already in assumption one is that the first order condition characterized the optima of this Hausdorff's problem. So you cannot just, in the end, you cannot come up with any crazy functional form for this V function. You need to cross-check in the end again to make sure that the second-order conditions are fulfilled as well. Yeah. But of course, second-order conditions also involve the production side of the economy. So that's why we set it up like this. Also, we didn't put any restriction that ensured that the income effect dominates the substitution effect. So this class also contains some cases where nu is negative, of course. You can have a negative nu. And then, of course, just the substitution effect dominates, and this would imply falling hours as wages grow, which is inconsistent with the data, but nevertheless interesting. Yeah. Kind of maybe a fun fact, we haven't found a full proof of the KPR result in the literature. So if you know a place where we can find a full proof of the KPR result, let us know, please. Kind of the reason for this is that kind of a way to prove it is you have to first prove this consumption curvature, so this coefficient of relative risk aversion in consumption. And in the KPR case, it's very easy to see that this has to be constant along the balanced growth path. However, and then King Plus Cerbello jumps directly from this to claiming that it must be equal to a parameter, which is independent of hours. Kind of for the foolproof, which turns out to be true in the end, but for the foolproof, you have to deal with the case that although it's constant, it can be potentially be a function of hours. And because hours will be constant in their framework, so it can potentially be a function of hours. And for a completeness of the proof, you have to deal with this case as well. And that's what we do if you wish. Okay. Yeah. So I have seven more minutes, right? Yeah. So let me show you some cases. So we saw already King plus Cerbello. Income and substitution effect cancel out each other. So of course this is nested in this class if you wish. And I think it's fair to say that this class completely dominated the macro literature. We provide a useful parameterization, and then we show that some interesting cases, we retrieve some interesting cases in our class which are not part of the KPR. So this is one interesting case, is this McCurdy case. So this is this additively separable structure. You have two separate parameters. One is the theta, which controls the Frisch elasticity, and sigma, which controls the consumption curvature. This is quite popular, this functional form. However, it's well known that the only way how you can make this consistent with a balanced growth of a constant hours is if you have you have to put sigma equal to 1, which is the law case. So if you, for instance, read Rob Scheimer's book, he starts out with this preference and then says, well, to be consistent with a balanced growth, we need to put sigma equal to 1, otherwise it's inconsistent with constant hours. And then for the rest of the book, he's assuming a log specification there. Key takeaway message here is that we get more degrees of freedom in the sense that we don't have to restrict this intertemporal elasticity of substitution, and this general McCurdy case is part of our class. Another interesting case which we retrieve in our class is Greenwald-Hertzowitz-Hoffmann, this kind of special function form of Greenwald-Hertzowitz-Hoffmann preferences. Those are those quasi-linear preferences where you don't have any income effect. Of course, without an income effect, those preferences would imply that hours work should be increasing as wages grow, which is inconsistent with the data. But nevertheless, it's remarkable, I think, to point out that we retrieve this case as well. Yeah. Interestingly, in the KPR, this coefficient of relative risk aversion in consumption is a constant. So it's a constant, it's the same across individuals for rich and poor, and it's also a constant over the business cycle. So it's not moving over the business cycle. In our case, you get more flexibility in this respect. So you get cases where this coefficient of relative risk aversion is higher for poor individual than rich individual, even along the balanced growth path, and where this coefficient of relative risk aversion in consumption is moving over the business cycle. So, and of course, this might be interesting because this could generate cases where people, because this is related to the risk aversion, so people are more risk averse in a recession where consumption is below trend. So, yeah, let me mention this at least. Kind of our main theorem is built around this standard representative agent macro model. So it's in a way a bit old-fashioned, if you want. And for this reason, I think it's relevant to ask the question, is this theorem only relevant in this representative agent framework, or is it actually more general? And the answer to this question is a clear no. It's more general than that. For instance, and that's what we do in the paper, you can have a more modern style macro model, you can have a Biele-Huggett Iagari model where you have a restriction, incomplete markets model with income shocks and even preference shocks if you want. And you can show by just detrending all the variables that even such a modern style heterogeneous agent model is consistent. Once you use those preferences, is consistent with a balanced growth path where hours worked are falling at the constant rate and all the other macroeconomic variables, if you take the averages, are growing at the constant rates. Whereas, of course, in the cross-section, you will have a distribution of wages, distribution of wealth, distribution of consumption, and also hours worked, of course. Yeah. So then, what are we doing out of this theorem and this theory? Clearly, it speaks to this literature on comparing hours worked between the U.S. and Europe. And I think, we call this Prescott-Rogerson versus other debate. And I think the most striking picture for that is this picture. So this compares in the post-war period hours worked in the U.S., we saw this more or less flat line, to European countries like France or Germany. And then Prescott and Rogerson asked the question, what is explaining this differential trend? And their conclusion is, and they use a King plus Rubella framework. So they use a framework where the baseline should be constant hours worked, and what they conclude is that taxes and transfer systems, differential trend in taxes and transfer system can account for this differential trend. Yeah. So, of course, it somehow calls for revisiting this question because with this new perspective, what you have to explain with tax and transfers will be different. So the result might be different. Yeah. So I think then there are interesting implications for the growth theory. So to the extent that we are right, clearly you can already ask the question in a sense, this is a matter of definition, but this is an endogenous growth theory. Because the long-run growth rate of this economy, of output consumption, will not only be a function of technical change, this gamma, it will now also be a function of this new parameter. So the long-run growth rate is a function of technology parameter and preference parameter. So in this sense, depending on the definition, you might call it already an endogenous growth here. Then, of course, there will be welfare gains, even along the balanced growth path in the long run, which are considerable, because people can take more days off. I think the most striking implication is, to some extent, to the extent that you believe in this story, it says that you cannot study growth and labor supply in isolation because they are ultimately connected to each other. Finally, there might be some interesting implication with respect to the business cycle literature because you have this moving risk aversion over the business cycle and particularly also for asset pricing literature because in the cross-section you can get cases where poor households are more risk-averse than rich households. So let me just wrap up then. So I think to some extent what we do here is an ambitious project, because what we say is that our beloved neoclassical growth model is empirically wrong and needs to be changed. And we provide a fix for that. So we provide, in our main theorem, we provide the most general class of utility function that gives you a balanced growth path and allows for changing hours in the long run. Yeah. And then, of course, once we have this theorem, I think there are some interesting implications of this theory. And of course, and this is maybe one important point, is that it also suggests quite different predictions for the future. Because if we have this stable utility function, income effects slightly dominate, to the extent that we are right, as productivity grows, and if productivity keeps on growing in the future as well, we predict that hours worked will be falling also in the US in future, even further. Okay. Thank you.